This is Classic Business with Michael Avery on Classic 1027 in Gauteng and FMR in Cape Town.
Well, as I look across my screen, it is a stormy sea that we are faced with in markets at the moment. And I've got Liston Meintjes, Portfolio Manager at Invest Securities, in studio to help us navigate these rather choppy waters. Liston, how are you doing?
Yeah, reasonably well. The story of red and blood on the floor, you know, we know the famous saying, buy when the blood is running in the streets, and we often make that analogy. But there's another problem, and that is a lot of people fall into what I call bottom fishing. They guess the bottom, and it isn't the bottom. It goes down another 10%. You don't have to look at anything better than Naspers. When it broke 300, people said, buy. Oh. It went to 270. They said, that's the bottom. It went to 250. They said, that's the bottom. And I'm not sure exactly where it finished today, but I saw it at 2370.
That's where I'm seeing it on my screens at the moment, 3.5% down. It means it's down over 30%. Year to date, and that is hefty. It was not too long ago that, as a fund manager, it was a difficult conversation to explain to your clients why you weren't overweight in Naspers. Last year, when it was shooting the lights out, I think a very different conversation now if you swam against the 10-cent tide. Could you have foreseen this happening, Liston?
I was at a risk conference in Cape Town last week, and most certainly one of the speakers were saying, yes, you could have. And part of it relates to governance. He covered it in Steinhoff, he covered it in Aspen, he covered it in MTN. And he was basically saying that, you know, these coming events cast a shadow. And quite often, you know, you have to look at the various statements and strategies that people are making and taking. But I think in Naspers, I've always said, you know, I think it's very difficult, you know, to be prudent against an imprudent benchmark. Now, unfortunately for some funds, notably the industrial funds, you know, the Naspers weighting is ridiculously high at something exceeding 30%. So if you weren't in that, you were just bottom of the log. If you're now not in it, you're top of the log. So really, you know, but to see it 30% off, I think if you go back in history, you'll find that this has happened 3 or 4 times in Naspers' history. It's not an unknown. But the problem, and always, was the risk. You know, we always try to balance return with risk, and we're never sure. But, you know, one of the early pioneers of modern portfolio theory thought the standard deviation of the return was a risk. I don't know that that's anything like what people understand by the word risk. Risk is when the prices go down on a continuous basis. That's something different. And we talk about that as drawdown. And we even talk about maximum drawdown and words like that. But so could anybody have foreseen it? Again, I always said it really rested, or the model really rested, on the fact that the Chinese authorities could pull a plug any time. And then we saw them do it. So it's not as though you had to be super bright. You saw them do that. Mm. And then you said, no, well, it won't really affect. No, well, you see. And unfortunately, that is not a good strategy.
When those are human biases, and they won't pull the rug out from underneath their national champion in Tencent. Why would they ever stop handing out gaming licenses? Well, it's exactly what we've seen happen. And it's also been caught up in a broad-based tech sell-off, hasn't it? We've seen the Nasdaq come under a lot of pressure this October, talk of it being Red October, and that's also played its part. This is not to say that it can't bounce back from these levels, though, Liston.
No, absolutely. I would count on a Santa Claus rally, as we call it. But, you know, the month of October, and I've written this in a couple of articles, we call it the ghost of October. And many of the bad events have occurred in that time. And we're talking about 1987, we're talking about 1929, we're talking about 1907, and nobody remembers the crash of 1904, but also in October.
You weren't around for that one, Liston.
I wasn't.
but it does bear repeating that the market goes through cycles, it goes through periods of correction. So the best advice for investors through times like this, if they've got a long enough time horizon, is really just to ride out a lot of the swells.
Well, again, you see, long-term sounds good. And, you know, one of the definitions of a long-term investor is a person who bought higher up.
Well, it is always about your base and your starting point. I know Socrates said, he is rich who is content with the least, for contentment is the wealth of nature. So I suppose investors should be fairly content at the moment because they've been settling with the least returns for a long time on the local market.
Again, looking at Naspers over 3 years, you know, it's up about 16 or so percent, which averages out to 5% a year, which is not great. But if you go a little further back, you're talking about, you know, three times your money over 5 years. Now, cheapers, that's okay. So it really does depend when you got in. And yes, I have one colleague who has always said to me, you know, Liston, he said, there are only two prices that matter, the price at which you bought and the price at which you sold. Everything in between is a figment of the imagination.
It sounds like he's a private equiteer, the first one in the room looking for the exits when they enter. But, I mean, that is what this game is about at the end of the day. Just one more point on Naspers. I see the MSCI is going to be announcing its decision on the one vote, one share rule by the end of October. And last time I checked, we're pretty much there. I haven't heard anything out of MSCI. Just take us through what this means in terms of the impact on not only Naspers. We're talking the likes of Remgro and Mr. Price and Richemont, all these companies that have these tiered voting structures.
Well, I think, and again, it doesn't just apply to South African shares. It applies to a number of tech shares that you were talking about earlier. The big story is, they're not happy where the control rests with not the entirety of the shareholders. And some of those control structures are crazy as to what you're allowed to vote on and, you know, whom, how much. Now, Naspers in particular has a control structure in which the N shares have something like 1,000th the vote of the ordinary shares, which are not listed. You have to be in the club to get them.
Yeah.
So, you know, that certainly isn't sound. But, you know, they've had proposals. There's a very good document going around by Miski saying, you know, on what basis and the arguments for and against. And they've pretty well come down in saying, you know, what they think they're going to do. And largely, you know, people are in there, and as a shareholder, you have a share of the profits. So as long as you have that, who is too worried about the voting structure? You can always opt out. You can leave. You don't have to vote. You can vote with your money.
Yeah.
So that's important. But I just had a look at a page, I think it is page 19 out of 45 on this document. And by the way, lots of documents are exceedingly long, but it just gives an indication if they were to go through what they call a free float adjustment and apply that on the voting structure as well. So they're kind of using a twin-edged, and something like Alphabet, for instance, will lose half its market cap straight off. Now, that's quite serious, wouldn't you think? But when you come to Naspers, if they apply the same rules, they've just called it simulated impact list, and Naspers goes down from 99 billion to it loses 61 billion. So it loses two-thirds of its market cap waiting in the Miski if they proceed with that. So it is absolutely material. I mean, a huge number of funds worldwide now are index trackers.
Will they be forced sellers?
And they will become forced sellers. I just think it is worth making that point. And for all we know, but again, somewhere in the middle of this, I haven't studied it in depth, but they say, you know, companies that are going to be most affected will have 3 years to correct. In other words, we will proceed as was, but over 3 years, if they don't stop the ends or they make give the ends the same vote, well, then they'll lose nothing. Mm. So again, management will be faced with a terrible choice here. Do we surrender control in order to keep our value? And let's be honest, a lot of management have share options that they would like to see higher. It will be quite interesting.
Well, that is a very interesting dilemma that faces management. And as you allude to, many of those tech stocks in the US have that structure. They were brought to market often by VC investors or private equity funds. And as founders, they wanted to keep control in that whole IPO process. But that's certainly going to come under the
spotlight. Well, certainly there are 12 that would absolutely be excluded.
Wow.
So I won't mention their names. They're nothing that most people are invested in. But something like MasterCard, it will have no effect upon. But the one that really is serious is a company called Roche Holding. they have a market cap of 219, and they will lose 137 of that. Quite significant.
Yeah, quite significant, I think, might be the understatement of the year.
But at least they've told us. It is not as though we can say, oh, I didn't know, and why didn't I write and tell them
what I thought? There's line of sight, but there's also an argument to be made that surely the regulators, the exchanges, should be playing this role. And why is MSCI trying to step into the shoes of the regulator?
You have to go back to the history. And why is it called MSCI? It's Morgan Stanley Capital International. And they were operating in the 60s and unhappy with the way that indices were being created. And independently they operated. And then they found, why don't we just join forces? So it's actually the Morgan Stanley Capital International Index.
Well, let's cross now to Pusaletsa for the latest traffic report, and we'll pick up on those quarterly labour force numbers, which were a shocker after the break.
This is Classic Business with Michael Avery on Classic 1027 in Gauteng and FMR in Cape Town.
Welcome back to Classic Business. Liston Maintjies of Invest Securities in studio with your view from the markets. Liston, that quarterly I call it the unemployment survey. It probably should be renamed the unemployment survey. The quarterly employment and labour force survey really doesn't paint a very flattering picture of where we are. It's backward looking, though, but the numbers are shocking. I just wanted to repeat a tweet from Mike Schussler here, if I may. He tweeted that the expanded unemployment is now 9,759,000 adults. It's the highest number ever, and that expanded rate is 37.3%, the highest rate of the current definition of expanded unemployment in history, an equivalent, in fact, more than the entire population of Greater Johannesburg. It's a real crisis.
No, absolutely, and it has been for some time. And I've said, you know, this is the problem facing the president and the ANC as the ruling party. And one of their platforms was, you know, we're going to create jobs. I've seen the NDP, I've seen GEAR, I've seen the ASGISA, I've seen them all. And unfortunately, they all said we'll get to low unemployment in the next 5 years. And like the Russian five-year plans, nothing ever happened. So, you know, here we are 25 years into the new democracy, and the numbers, as you say, are horrifying in total. But the big point is, did this make you change your mind? Because basically, it's been signaled from all over. If I can, for the listeners, just cover a couple of things. The first thing, and I'm really summarizing a summarized table, because otherwise we can go into huge detail. I think it's a 131-page report.
It is vast.
And who's got time for that except the economists? You know, we investment managers have to concern ourselves with something more important. But so it didn't really make me change my mind on anything. I'll just highlight a couple of things. So the population that they're talking about is 15 to 64. Now, I don't know how many people are in the labor force at 15. Certainly not in the group that I encounter. But so what has happened is that population expanded 1.6%, which is about in line with what I would have thought it would do. The number employed increased by 1.2%. So you say, well, hey, if population increased 1.6 and employed went up 1.2, then unemployment must have gone up more than 1.6. It didn't. Unemployed went up naught. Oh, now how did that happen? And the actual story is that it's what they call not economically active.
The NEETs.
The NEETs, yeah. And in that, and this is the important one, is that the other, goodness knows how it's defined, that only went up one, but what they call the discouraged. So they're not unemployed, they're discouraged because they've been so long unemployed. And I'm not sure that number shouldn't be added in somewhere to tell us the real truth. And yeah, that's where Mike is coming from. So the discouraged went up 12.2%. But it was on a 2,400,000 base. But if you look at the employed, the actual formal employment, which is the largest portion by a long way of 11 million, went down 1.1%. That's serious, but we've known about it. We've seen layoffs and we've seen strikes about layoffs and we've seen mining jobs disappearing. I mean, nothing of this is new, actually. But the informal, now, sorry to challenge the statistician general, but how do you check on the informal unemployment or employment.
It is by definition.
It's informal, difficult to obtain.
But you chat to someone like a Gigi Alcock or one of these guys who makes a living trying to understand the dynamics of the so-called informal economy, and there is a large layer under there that's not being measured. Of individuals who are running businesses out of second rooms of RDP homes, looking after babies, washing hair during the day. There is a lot of economic activity that I think doesn't get tracked and certainly would if it were measured, add significantly to our understanding of where we are as a country in terms of our social cohesion. Mm-hmm. There's no way that a country with 37 point whatever it is expanded unemployment can remain as socially cohesive as we have for the last 25 years.
Well, again, I can wax on that as well. If you look at the number on the benefit, it's 17 million. The number employed is 16 million. So already we have a dynamic not seen in any other country that I know of. I mean, maybe Zimbabwe and a couple of others. But if you go further and you say that of the people employed, a huge proportion, and I believe the number is as high as 80%, don't pay any personal income tax because they earn below the 75,000 rand threshold. So only 20%. People pay tax. But worse than that, of the personal tax, which is by far the largest in the budget, not by far, it's followed closely by VAT, and for all I know with the VAT sure. increase, the yep. two are equal. But 30, just over 30% of total tax take comes from what we call personal income tax. And that 80% of that is paid by 800,000 entities. Now, not counting corporations. Now, 80% at 800,000 means 800,000 people are paying 25% of the total tax in this country. Now, that must be a shock somewhere.
It's completely unsustainable to have.
How you work fiscal policy around that, I just defy. And so you can have an investment conference, you can have all sorts of things, but unless you realize the total dynamics here, and then people say to me, but how do you fix it? And I say, well, that's not my job. My job is to invest based on the facts that I can see, and they are not happy.
Quite clearly a discussion that could keep us busy for the rest of the show, I think, Listed. I'd like to move on to an interesting set of results from Premier Fishing, and it gives us an opportunity to do a bit of an analysis, and it's not just the PE ratio and the dividend yield and all of that. So let's firstly look at Premier Fishing. How are the profits generated?
Well, big story, and it's an unusual company, spun out of Premier, as you know, but it really does just fishing. And when they do their segmental analysis, you find quite interesting items that you do not find in a normal segmental analysis by any stretch of the imagination. So in amongst their segmental analysis, you'll find lobster, pelagica, hake, squid, abalone. Now, we all know these various things, and we may like them or dislike them. But again, you're saying, you know, what really drives this company's profits. And the question is sending fleets out to collect them or collect them on the seashore, depending on exactly where you are and how yep. you go about them, and building perhaps, you know, greater tracts of land, you know, which you can, as they call it, farm.
Aquaculture. Yeah, yeah.
Aquaculture. So, again, it's a fascinatingly different company, and I think people should accept that. And I know one farmer in the Free State, he said he liked fishing shares because the fish didn't know what the weather was like.
But that said, though, the fish don't know what the weather's like. But what are the risks? Is climate change a potential risk here? Is overfishing? Is licensing and regulation? All of those.
Absolutely. As I say, that's key in anybody, you know, deciding that they want to buy into a company like this. And just looking at a price earnings multiple or the dividend yield is not the right way. You have to look at the risks, and you have to say, if I buy at this price, am I being adequately rewarded for the risks that I can and see? And of course, then there's always some that you don't see, you know, such as unplanned maintenance of the vessels, meaning that we had a storm of one kind or another. You talked about perfect storm at the beginning, and as you know, bad weather ships landing aground kind of go together. So exactly as you say. But you know, you look at the long term, and you look to see which one is doing well or better, and it should come as no surprise that the major driver is lobster.
major driver is lobster. We all love lobster, and we all love Liston Maincheese and his view from the markets here on Classic Business. Liston, thanks again.
Thank you.